My name is Rex Jury. I'm a member of the board of the Adelaide Press Club, but Grant Heading, our president, can't be here today, so I've drawn, well, do we call it the short straw? I'm not sure. But to all of you, welcome, particularly the many faces that we haven't seen here before. There's a lot of the regulars are here, and we're always pleased to see you. But to those that haven't been to a press club meeting before, welcome. It certainly is an auspicious day, and we're very lucky to have our guest speaker, Tom Phillips. The format is pretty easy. You'll be served your main courses in a minute. You'll get back to that tumultuous conversation that I couldn't make myself heard over when I stood up here. And I'm glad to see at this table down here, the Telstra table looks like it's full of trouble, and if they're out of here at 2 o'clock, as the running sheet says, I'll be very surprised. I would like to acknowledge Telstra. They've been a great supporter of the Press Club for a long time, as have SA Brewing, Harm Premium, floating around all over the place. There's the Light, James Squire Amber, and so on and so on. Our trusted wine sponsors, Orlando, have once again been very generous. Alec Matheson's going to his third glass already, and it's only 25-1. I won't list the wines that you've got before you, but Orlando have been great sponsors of ours. The main course will be served in a moment, but first of all, there's no such thing as a free lunch, even though you've paid for it. On your table, you will see books of raffle tickets. The Press Club works on very slim margins, and the only way we can keep our financial head above water is through the raffle tickets. So if you wouldn't mind, I'd urge you to... I think there's 3 tickets for $5 or $1 each. So, and there's some pretty good prizes. Telstra once again gives a cordless phone. There's beer and other things. So, please dig into your pockets generously. There's a couple of people I would like to acknowledge here today. Apart from our guest speaker Tom Phillips, we've got the Mayor of Marion, Felicity Ann Lewis. I mentioned that to Tom as he came in, and he said, "I know Felicity," and then they flung their arms around each other. I don't know what's going on there. Stephen Polaris, the DPP, the last guest speaker, I think, Stephen. And if we get as much publicity from this lunch as we did from the last one, we're doing very well. Mal Hemmeling, CEO of the City Council, Professor Kerry Green from the University of Adelaide, Rob DeMonte, an old sparring partner of mine on SA Great, Mark Sell from Marion, and Kevin Taylor from Mitsubishi. We've also got here Kim Richardson in a ridiculous T-shirt. Where are you, Kim? The local member for Kingston, who claims to have signed on, but we haven't seen the car unless that's yours parked on the footpath out the front. Please enjoy your lunch. I'll come back a little after 1 o'clock and formally... introduce our guest speaker, get into those raffle tickets, and we'll be back in half an hour. Thank you. Today's guest fits absolutely perfectly with our program of guest speakers who are relevant, and there's nothing more relevant in South Australia at the moment than the Mitsubishi 380. I once, a couple of years ago, had to introduce George Negus to a press club lunch. And I said, George Negus is a man who needs no introduction. And then I went on to introduce him, and when he got up on the stage, he said, "You're a bloody idiot." He said, "You say I need no introduction, and then you talk about me for 5 minutes." But it would be true of Tom Phillips that he's a man who really needs no introduction in South Australia. But I do need to say, Tom, that I apologise for this morning's advertiser, which had a Holden on the front page on the day after you launched your 380, but there you go. Nothing's perfect. But we know that since Tom came to Adelaide to join Mitsubishi from Toyota 5 years ago, he's become a legend in this town, a sort of icon. He single-handedly saved Mitsubishi from closure. He single-handedly put out a new model. He plays off a golf handicap of 3 down at Goolwa. That's about all you need to know about him, I think. So instead, I'm going to breach a confidence, a secret between Tom and I, which really tells you more about Tom than all those statistics, even his handicap of 3. Early this year, I wrote a story about a woman who was running a drug rehabilitation service down in the southern suburbs. And she was driving a very old Mitsubishi, which was just about rooted. And her single-handed drug rehabilitation welfare service was going to go down with it. Anyway, a few weeks later, I was given the gig of writing a column on the back page of the Sunday Mail. And on about Wednesday, I looked at this sort of blank page and thought, what the hell am I going to do? And I rang Tom and I said, Tom, is there anything you can tell me about your rotten bloody car that's coming along? And he said, come down and you can have a look at the thing. And at that stage, you had to have your fingerprints taken and you weren't allowed to have any metal objects with you. And we drove down to the back of the plant, opened a door with 3 locks on it and went through black curtains. And there were 3 ghosts of cars under silk shrouds. And we pulled them off and Tom said, sit in it. You can sit in it. Now, I know nothing about cars. Nothing at all. So I tried to take notes, but I didn't know what I was looking at. And Tom said, don't write too much about this, will you? I'm just giving you a look at it anyway. I don't know what too much was, but it gave me my first column on the back page of the Mail. Thank you, Tom. And we went back to his office for a cup of coffee, and he called this fellow in, and he said, have you got it yet? And the fellow said, yeah, I've got it. Bloody hell. He was obviously agitated. And he said, you know that woman you wrote about, we're going to give her a car. And that woman has now expanded her drug rehabilitation service from the southern suburbs to the eastern suburbs, which takes in the city area. She's now operating up in the Riverland and down in the southeast. And she's doing that because Tom gave her a car. He didn't seek any publicity. He didn't want any publicity. It was a secret between the two of us. I breached that confidence, but I think it tells you more about Tom Phillips and Mitsubishi than all I can say about, all I can read from his CV. Yesterday, when he launched his new car, which he single-handedly built and marketed, Tom said, of the 380, it's better built, better backed, and I better bugger off, and so better I. Tom Phillips.
As George Neger says, Rex, you are a bloody idiot. Right? But, look, I appreciate those very generous comments. I can assure you I had no part in building that car. One of the things that I enjoyed about Rex's visit was that very clearly he knew nothing about motoring. So anything I told him, you know, he took for granted. And it wasn't like the normal test I'd be put through or whatever, but I did appreciate his interest, and it's... I said it's a great pleasure for me to be here today. As far as the ladies' car is concerned, Rex, there's no such thing as a rooted Mitsubishi, right? Sometimes people have thought Mitsubishi itself was rooted. I've sometimes felt rooted, but but we persevered. So I want to say thank you for inviting me here today. I didn't quite know what to expect. It's my first time I've been here. I didn't quite know what to expect. When they say press club, I'm thinking it's all journalists. And in the past, I've had reason to think twice about that. According to my PR people, this is media engagement number 4,214 for the year so far for me. I think that's a bit understated, but it feels certainly a lot more. And I have to be honest, there is a light at the end of the tunnel. It's not that I'm counting, but, you know, 15 days, 11 hours and so many minutes, and all this public speaking type stuff will be behind me. However, I do think it's probably been all worth it. As I would certainly hope most of you are aware, apart from holding on the front page of the paper this morning, yesterday at the Sydney International Motor Show, I finally launched to the public our all-new Mitsubishi 380. So I thought today I might share with you some of the story about how we finally got our new car to launch, and then move on to a little bit about what I'm going to be doing in the future, which is not about public speaking. Of course, yesterday had all the usual motor show glitz and glamour, but in amongst it all, it did occur to me that after 40 years in this industry, I joined General Motors in 1965, it will probably be the last time that I will launch a new car in the Australian market. Now, it's worth thinking a little bit about what changed in the industry in that time. Those of you who remember will admit to, or who will admit to being old enough to remember, will no doubt recall cars like the all-new HD Holden, as it says in the article, the style setter for 1965. Holden in those days had 36% of the market, and as I said, I worked for General Motors, and the pressure that used to come on once it dropped below about 35, or 30, you would not believe it. It was a market dominated by Holden, and then Ford, and then Chrysler. American brands ruled, with the European Volkswagen, Austin and Hillman forming a second tier. In amongst this mix were some little companies with strange-sounding Japanese names selling cheap little cars that no one took too seriously. The biggest, Toyota, had a huge 3.4% market share, with Datsun and Mazda at less than 1%. In terms of manufacturers, or at least assemblers, there have certainly been quite some changes. And have a look at some of these names. Interestingly, I don't know what happened to the Willys Motor Group, but they certainly seem to have a sound product plan. To quote the 1965 Automotive Industry Yearbook, the company was formed with the object of manufacturing a complete range of all-purpose, go-anywhere vehicles. It seems to me that they saw the SUV market before any of us, which goes to show there's no great product, that even great product planning is no guarantee for success. And of course, from a 1965 perspective, unimaginable advances in technology in cars. This state-of-the-art beauty boasted amazing features such as push-button radio, turning indicators, a column-mounted shift lever for the automatic transmission, a two-tone steering wheel and an optional heater. But missed the integrated, of course, DVD entertainment and satellite navigation systems. However, you did get a brand new AP6 Valiant for the princely sum of $2,500. In 1965, just over 400,000 new cars were registered in the market of about 11.5 million people. This year, the industry is forecasting to sell, for the first time ever, around 1 million cars. This is 2.5 times the number of cars sold 40 years ago, but that's roughly, as you can see, in line with the growth in Australia's population. So if we look at the past 40 years in summary, the size of the market, yes, it's bigger, basically in line with population growth. Market shares have certainly shifted from the American brands to the Japanese companies. Australian manufacturing is still here, but it's in different shape than what it was. And of course, with technology, well, there's no doubt that this has been a major area of change. However, with all the change that has occurred, I propose that the most fundamental requirement for success has in fact not changed at all. At the end of the day, whether you are back in 1965 or today in 2005, Success is all about getting consumers to buy your product. In this regard, over the last 5 years at Mitsubishi, we have tried to drive into the company a strategy of sales success based on some fairly simple principles. One, develop a good product, but a product based on what consumers want, not on what engineers or designers or senior management may want. For this reason, right through the development process for the 380, we have insisted on the most extensive market research program ever undertaken by the company. Every decision, every choice that we have made for this car, we have tested in the market. Secondly, build trust in the brand. All brands will go through cycles of being fashionable or being flavour of the month. The foundation for sustained long-term sales success, however, is trust. And frankly, this is by far the biggest challenge that I've faced with Mitsubishi over the past 5 years. And with all our well-documented problems, it was the reason, particularly through 2004, it was the reason I had to go in the end resort to appearing in our commercials myself. And that was certainly a last resort. And it's interesting, some of the reactions to the advertising. I talked about this in various places. One of the most interesting comments I got in Sydney last month when I was doing a presentation up there to a couple of hundred people. And a guy stood up and said, well, you know, he said, I'm amazed at how successful the advertising has been. He said, because you've got such a bland voice. And that is probably true. And it's one of the reasons why I hated doing it. But, you know, we seem to have got away with it. One of the other things that's happened to me is that wherever I go now, I'm continually being people are asking me, are you Ron Barassi? Right? And I've had that, you know, for quite a while now. And of course, I'm always very honoured and humbled to say, well, no, I'm not. Well, I wish I was. I wish I was that great sportsman. And interesting, last month I heard that someone went up to Ron Barassi and said, are you Tom Phillips? And he said, piss off! No, there are some benefits there too, I'm sure. Our corporate confidence campaign over the past 12 months has been about rebuilding trust, rebuilding confidence in the Mitsubishi brand. Until we could do that, there's still work to do. Nothing else would have mattered. If we hadn't done that campaign, I don't think, you know, we would have wasted all the development in the car, because people just wouldn't have been interested. The third and final principle that I've tried to instill in the company is that at the end of the day, business is about people and people are about relationships. After 40 years in the automotive industry, working for General Motors, Nissan, Toyota, I kept moving around until I found, you know, a job I could do. Then I doubted it at the end. And of course, Mitsubishi, I've been fortunate enough to have had the opportunity to travel the world and work with an incredibly diverse range of people. The key point, though, is that it is people that I've been working with, not machines and not books and not processes. Developing and maintaining relationships, whether it's by simply giving someone a call, having a lunch or just catching up for a drink, adds the personal dimension to business and is the greatest and, frankly, the most satisfying conduit to success. And it is effective with just about anyone, bosses, subordinates, I think colleagues, suppliers, dealers, unions, politicians, bureaucrats, and dare I say it, I've even managed to change the opinion of a few journalists over a beer. So that's it for what it's worth, my three principles for success in our industry and what I hope I've been able to instill at Mitsubishi Motors. So that's enough history, and what about the future? Well, I have to tell you, I get a bit nervous about predicting what's going to happen in the future of the automotive industry, but then again, I think I'm not alone. I've been wrong before, and so have other people. It seems there have been quite a few clangers of prediction made over history, even amongst the ranks of the media. Journalists, and dare say it, even some editors, have not exactly had a great record in forecasting future events in the automotive industry. In 1902, the editor of Harper's Magazine confidently predicted the actual building of roads devoted to motor cars is not for the near future, in spite of many rumours to that effect. In 1909, the editors of the prestigious science journal, Scientific American, revealed, and this is one I particularly like, the automobile has particularly reached the limit of development. Then there was the editor of Business Week in the United States who confidently published the prediction that with over 50 foreign cars already on sale in the US, the Japanese auto industry isn't likely to carve out any big slice of the US market. And my favourite is the guy who predicted that by the year 2000, the automobile will have driven out the horse. Now, maybe a little late, but not bad so far. Where he goes, goes astray for anyone who has recently been on South Road or Glen Osmond Road during rush hour is his rush of blood, where he proclaims, and the trip from the suburban home to the office will require just a few minutes. And it's not just automotive forecasters who sometimes get it wrong. Economic writer, a man of great fame, Max Walsh, and I got this story from his editor, from the Bulletin, has predicted 34 of the last three recessions. You've got to think about that. So instead of talking about some rampant speculation about the future of the automotive industry, I'm going to stay a bit more safer territory and talk about one of the things that I'm going to be doing in the future. Since announcing my departure from Mitsubishi, I'm very pleased and probably a bit relieved that I have received a number of approaches for roles in a number of organisations. At this stage, I'm still considering some options. My wife and I are very keen to stay in South Australia. And one of the things I have done, as you may know, I've accepted a role offered to me by the state government as chair of the Training and Skills Commission. And I thought I would tell you or remind you of some of the objectives of the Commission, because I think it's a very, very important thing. The Training and Skills Commission assists, advises and makes recommendations to state government on matters relating to higher education, vocational education and training and adult community education. It plays an important role in promoting quality, protecting apprentices and trainees throughout their training and providing industry and community advice to government about workforce development. We need to plan for and deliver skills for a range of projects, including, for example, the air warfare destroyers, the massive Roxby Downs expansion, and other aspects of the mining boom, for example. I look forward to the challenges ahead. In particular, I look forward to leading the state government's workforce development strategy, launched by Minister Key in August this year, and taking it forward to gain the outcomes the industry needs. The State Workforce Development Strategy has been prepared by the SA Training and Skills Commission and is a long-term approach to guide the development of South Australia's present and future workforce. It's a unique approach that links skills to the way work is organised and has never been attempted before in Australia. Putting the Workforce Development Strategy into action requires a strong partnership between government, industry, and that's where I hope I can play a part, and the Training and Skills Commission to ensure that we're able to collaboratively work together. I need some water. And deliver the skills that South Australia needs. We are experiencing a situation of skilled worker shortage. In a simplistic way, this is usually seen as a trade skills shortage. But in fact, the situation appears a bit more complex. Skill shortages exist when employers are unable to fill vacancies for an occupation at an appropriate level of pay or reasonable conditions. Occupations can be in shortage in some regions and not in others. For example, I understand we do have enough nurses in South Australia, but they choose not to work in their trained field for a variety of reasons, or they will not work in certain regions. Difficult locations, low remuneration, poor working conditions, unsatisfactory hours or ineffective recruitment methods can also make it difficult to attract sufficient or the most suitable workers. We cannot rank or give relative priority to different sectors, but some areas of immediate need are going to include, of course, manufacturing, food, mining, defence, transport, the creative industries, the arts, health services, tourism, wine and construction. While improving the output from formal education institutions and training organisations is one solution, it's also important for the right people to be available at the right time, and these people are available to translate their learning into the workforce. The training system alone cannot meet industry demand for a skilled workforce in an environment where there are just not enough people. Along with training, we need to look at other strategies to keep pace with changes in industries and industry demands. An effective workforce development system makes the labour market work well for both employees and employers. It goes beyond training and skills to include work organisation, job design, industrial relations, human resource management practices and employment conditions. It puts government and industry side by side to plan for workforce needs and to address recruitment, retention and good use of labour. Getting the right skills in the right place at the right time cannot be left to chance. It requires action from all industry sectors in need. Action begins with better workforce information and planning and a coordinated approach to developing our workforce. Industry and government must work together to address current and future workforce needs. Businesses need to be able to employ skilled people and seek opportunities for continued progress of people and their skills. Education and training systems and providers need to work closely with industry to ensure they can provide the skills that South Australia needs. So that's basically where I'm moving on from selling cars. There will be a few other things. As I am in the press club, I would like to take this moment to thank the media of South Australia. I think we've had our moments over the years, but generally there's been a heck of a lot of support, certainly a lot of interest. I don't know of any other company. I've lived in Brisbane, Sydney and Melbourne and now Adelaide. I don't know of any other company in Australia that's had the focus on it like Mitsubishi has in Adelaide. And perhaps there's been good reason. Obviously, being a major employer, a lot of jobs depend on it. So there is reason for it. But it has also, I think, added to a lot of pressure for the people. So hopefully from now on, you're going to see a lot of 380s on the road and you're going to see a very great company go on. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak today, and I now suggest we all get back to some serious relationship building. Thank you, Rex.
It's a great tradition in this press club lunch that we only have one flight of stairs on and off the stage, so the guest speaker can't escape. The second of those traditions is that the guest speaker, whoever he or she might be, is subjected to a grilling from the audience. And the third convention is that the working press, have a look at them down here from the advertiser, the professional press, the paid press, have priority on questions. But Tom, you won't mind taking questions.
No.
So I call on the room for questions, but working press first. Thank you. You may get none.
I'm Brian. Have you got anything left after yesterday? Whilst I'm standing here, of course, there is no such as a free lunch. Those of you may be guests, but I haven't really done a bit of a sell on the 380, which is probably the first time I've stood in front of a bunch of people for the last 2 years and not said anything about the 380 particularly, but the secret of this car, a lot of people are going to comment, and everyone has opinion on styling. So far we've had a very, very good feedback on styling. You're going to appreciate this car until you drive it. This is a sensational driving car, and it's all about the way the car's been built. It's been built better. I can say that. It's certainly been built differently the way any car's been built in Australia. And it's an absolute pleasure to drive. It's very quiet. It's sensational. As I said, a sensational handling car. And I don't want these words to go outside of this room, of course, but I will give you a couple of quotes from a couple of areas. There's a magazine in New Zealand called Autocar, which is the equivalent of our Wheels magazine. And next week they have a 16, and we send our car to New Zealand. There's no change, exactly the same spec. Next week they have a 16-page story on our new car and New Zealand Autocar. And the editor has humbly described it as the Lexus of Australia. Now I don't want you to repeat that because I'm not before enough to suggest that we're in that league, but you might want to share the story from time to time. The other one was that another journalist has been driving a a very popular, very expensive, I think probably 3-4 times the price of this European car, and says the 380 kills it, handling wise. So it's a pretty good package. You've got to drive it to appreciate it, and you know, I'm very proud to be part of the team that's put it together. Over to you, Brian. Don't ask me about petrol. Don't ask me, is this going to make or break?
My first question was going to be, Tom, are you sick of the sight of me yet? But obviously you are. Tom, I've driven the car. I know it's a, it is a very good car. But is there such a thing as a bad car coming to the market at the moment?
Look, I think, first of all, the laws of the land make sure that there's no such thing as a bad car. I think there's different levels of quality, and you know, things are done differently with different cars. And as I said, I think the secret of this car is in the, actually in the manufacturing process. That's what stands us apart. But you know, they all have quite, you know, they're basically three-year warranties. No one matches our 5-10 warranty, I might add. But they're all, I mean, you couldn't say there's a bad car out there.
Tom, I just a question on pricing. You've come in under Holden and Ford's large car or large car offerings, and you've created a new market positioning below that large car offering, slightly ahead of the European models, the sportier things. You've told us that you're aiming for a different market there. Is 380 able to clip the wings of the likes of Mazda 6, Honda Accord Euro, and the Sonata, which does compare very compares with 380 quite well on size and power?
Yeah, look, I think firstly, I think the Sonata is a good package. On the Honda and the Mazda, when we were doing our research on the styling of this car, we did include the Honda Euro and the Mazda 6 in the styling clinics. And we're always very happy with the outcome. We've had a Honda Euro out at work now for 12 months, and it's been used for comparison purposes on build quality and on performance. We come up very well against them.
Yesterday, Hyundai...
The Mazda 6 is a four-cylinder too.
Yes. Right? Yesterday, Hyundai revealed the new Grandeur, a V6, very comparable with a 380. Was that unsettling?
Nothing unsettles me at the moment, mate. I've got a great car. I just can't wait to get it on the road. I mean, there's a lot of competition. We can't ignore the competition. And every day there's going to be something new come at us. And we've done the best we can. I think we've got a good package. As I said, we get people in to drive this car. I think they're going to be very impressed.
Thanks for your time today and over the last couple of months. Cheers, Tom.
Thank you. Thanks, Brian.
Tonya Madigan, Channel 9. Tom, we're hearing that there has to be sales of 32,000 of these cars to make it a viable option. Realistically, number one, how many do you think you can sell? And number two, how many do you need to sell to secure the future of Mitsubishi here?
Well, our production target's 32,000, which includes 2,000 export to New Zealand. Now, we're taking that as the base level. So, you know, we're not going out there saying we're going to sell 40,000. We expect to achieve that target as a minimum.
And to secure the future of Mitsubishi here?
Sorry?
How many would you need to sell to secure the future
of Mitsubishi? We need to sell 32,000 at this stage. So what we need to do is put the score on the board for our shareholders. Their target to us is 32,000 at this stage. Now, it's a small number in terms of manufacturing in this country. We all know that. So we have to go beyond that. But first of all, we've got to show we can do this.
Have you been given any indication of when the crunch time is, when the future of Mitsubishi here will be reviewed again?
No, look, I think we've sort of locked in, you know, for the future with this car. We have a 5-year plan. You know, until we see anything different coming along, it's full steam ahead.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. That was a lineup. I didn't expect this.
So I'm Rod Savage from the Advertiser. It's 15 days and about 10 and a half hours now until Robert McInerney takes over. What happens if he or Mitsubishi in general starts making decisions that you don't agree with or that you think are in the wrong direction for the company, or indeed maybe disastrous for long-term strategy. Do you feel you'd be in a position to maybe make a quiet phone call, or would you even consider stepping in and saying, I think you're going in the wrong direction, given you've invested so much of your life into the company?
Look, I wouldn't have the right to do that. He'll be the CEO, and he'll be reporting to the shareholders in Japan. If he wishes to discuss anything with me, of course, I'll always be available. But, you can't have two CEOs. So, you know, I'm handing over. He's a very, very competent operator, and I think he'll do extremely well.
Tony, something terrible on the horizon looks like it's going to happen.
Just been born, right? So we're not looking at anything terrible on the horizon.
All right. Thank you, Tom.
Hi, Tom. Rachel Hancock from The Advertiser. I'm just interested to hear your opinions or your observations of the car market from a female perspective in terms of marketing, the concept design, and particularly the marketing. How has it changed in the 40 years you've been involved?
I'm having a little bit of trouble. It's the old age hearing, sorry.
The car market and targeting the female buyer, because certainly, from an editorial perspective, we've changed our way in that we now have a section that targets females and reviews cars from a female's perspective. And I'm interested to hear what you think about that market and how Mitsubishi in particular has changed its direction towards that market.
Well, I think, you know, obviously the female opinion is very important. I mean, we don't make any decisions without consulting with you. Well, that's interesting. Yeah, I know. It's something that I think when we, going back a few years, I think our marketing was probably, you know, too much targeted towards, you know, males. I think we've tried to change that. One of our designers is a young lady who's actually come out of the fashion industry. And, she's a very, very strong individual and has her points of view, and she's the only person in the company who can tell me I'm an idiot and I feel good about it, you know. So we talk about colours and trims, and, you know, I suddenly realise that, you know, I'm out of my league. And so, you know, she has a particular influence. And if you see the cars, the colours and so on, and the trims, I mean, that's all a female's work. And, but generally our marketing, you know, we have to be aware of it. I think, as I said, you know, some years ago, it was too much targeted to the male audience. And, you know, we have a wide range of cars, and we'd certainly appreciate that, within families, you know, the lady of the house has a lot of say in what sort of car is bought. So, yeah, we appreciate that.
Also, in terms of the, advertising strategy for Mitsubishi, was it your idea to become the face of it, or what was your opinion when they first said, hey, Tom, we want you to front it?
I don't mind plagiarising the story, a situation in America, a fellow called Lee Iacocca, who was head of Chrysler, had similar problems, and he went on television. And I always had this feeling that, you know, we're going to have to make a statement, and the only person who can make it is the CEO. Which I was, of course, and that's where it came from.
Paul Sterrick from The Advertiser. One question that you've touched on is the issue of the pressure on Mitsubishi and the scrutiny from the South Australian public, particularly in relation to its future. The question that seems to be on many lips is whether this is the last car to be built in Adelaide, and what reassurance can you give the South Australian public from your point of view that it won't be?
I can't give you any reassurance on that. I don't think any automotive manufacturer in Australia or anywhere could give absolute reassurance of that for the future. I mean, the scene is changing. There's a lot more competition. The tariffs are coming down. I think the Australian cars represent fantastic value, quite frankly. But they're under a lot of pressure, and the trick now is to be able to convince our parents, whether they're in Japan or in Detroit, that a big investment down here is worth something. And you've got to—I mean, I don't hide from the fact that, you know, selling 32,000 cars a year for the next 5 years is going to be our saviour. We have to get something else, but, you know, our first step now is to prove that we can sell this car, and then justify more investment, because it's big money, and companies now are looking, you put your money in Australia or do you put your money in China? Or, you know, or Thailand or something like that. So, you know, we have to be able to stand up and demonstrate a real business case. So nothing's certain anywhere. This car gives us a good shot at this stage, but as time goes on, who knows? Who knows for any of them, any of the manufacturers?
And just a second unrelated question. As an employer with a large unionised workforce, I'm wondering what your opinion is of the federal government's industrial relations laws and how they would change under, how Mitsubishi's operations would change.
No, well, I'm not talking industrial relations today.
No worries.
Right, thank you.
Christopher Galley, freelance. Some people say political parties are committing industrial harikiri in general and automobile harikiri in particular in constantly reducing tariffs and ignoring import quotas.
Mm.
To what extent do you agree with this view?
I think the reduction in tariffs has been a very good thing for the Australian public. You go back to the mid-80s when we started under what was then the Button Plan. I think the tariffs then were, the duty was 57.5%. It's come down considerably. It's now down to 10. But what it's done in that period is made the Australian manufacturers become globally competitive. So you've got levels of quality now that are equal to anything else in the world, which then gives you the opportunity, of course, to export to other parts of the world. Now, we don't have that situation with this car at the moment. We export to New Zealand, that's about it. But I think overall the reduction in tariffs has been certainly a great benefit to the Australian public. They've now got very, very high quality cars. It's been great benefit to the economy because our manufacturers can now compete on a global basis with exports, Holden and Toyota particularly. As far as the industry itself is concerned, we've known all through that process from the mid-80s right through till now what the circumstances are. You can't ignore China at this stage, but there's not much you've got to understand it. And I still think there's the way we have to go in the future is try and find a car that we can export to other parts of the world, because that's where most of the volume's going to be. This project started in 2002, and we were a two-car project. And most of our volume at that stage, the second car, was for export. Now that made a lot of economic sense, and I think that's what we need to get to in the future. So building cars in Australia is okay. Our costs at this stage, we reckon are probably about 80% of Japan and about 80% of the US. So we can build high quality, at very competitive costs. You have a bit of distance to cover, but overall, you know, we can still produce. The issue is, you know, what's going to come out of China and so on. But I think we can't as an industry complain about the government policies, because whilst they've been, say, reducing tariffs on one hand, they've also been getting incentives on the other. So overall, it's been a good balance. But competition is very tough, and no one can legislate for that.
What about, unlike many other countries, the absence of import quotas?
No, I don't think so. I think, we are a free market, and as I said, we'd all like to just, back in the 80s, it was mostly, in the 70s and 80s, it was mostly Australian-built cars. And really, they were not good cars. And so you can't have... today has changed, we have greater quality, but competition is what drives quality, I think. And if we just say, well, we're going to close the market off to competition, then, you know, we're not going to necessarily produce the best cars in the world some of the best cars in the world as we do now.
Sarah Cumming from Channel 7. I'm just wondering how you respond to critics of the 380 who say it's a bit of a dinosaur in terms of not having the factory-fitted gas at a time when some companies are even moving towards diesel engines.
Well, the only critics have been from Channel 7, actually. But they talked about... I didn't see the story, but I heard about it. And as I said, I'll probably... you know, 100 or so media stories yesterday. It was the only one that made some comments. And they talked about, you know, we don't have an aluminium engine and other things. The reality of life is that we are a cleaner car than our competitors. We have equal power. We have better fuel economy. So there are ways of doing these things without necessarily, you know, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to go in other directions. And as new cars come out on the track, we have to deal with those situations as well. We have a very good package. And those, you can talk about technology, but, you know, people still got to pay for it. And we still have in our car, our base car, we're the only company with four airbags, right? The only car. The only county car with, say, 5-speed automatic transmission is standard. The others don't have it. So, you know, you can say, well, you know, I'd rather have an aluminium engine, but you're going to get better fuel economy, equal performance, and so on out of this car, and at a very competitive price. So we'll adjust to the competitors as they move through to their new models, next year and so on. We're aware of what's happening, and it's not going to be easy, but right now we have a little window which we're going to take advantage of.
Okay, and just to revisit the sales target issue,
yes.
Was it set deliberately low to avoid the possible perception of failure?
No, it's not set. It's set at a level that we need to achieve. This started as a two-car strategy, and the two-car strategy was 65,000 to 70,000 vehicles. The other half of, you know, the other 30,000-odd were going to be exported. This car was always been since 2002 around the low 30,000s, and we haven't changed that. And, you know, it's going to be nice to be able to say we did 33 or 35 or 40, but we think this is the minimum number.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Jeez, is anyone working at the advertiser today?
No?
We turn the lights off on the way out. No?
Stuart, my program, we're hearing things about some fairly new and interesting ideas in terms of marketing a vehicle. Can you give us a rundown on some or all of those?
Well, some of you are not seeing in Adelaide, unfortunately. Yesterday in Sydney and Melbourne, we had an eighth page. It was a fold-out, and it was in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age, because they have the capacity to now do that sort of printing. And that was something that's quite unique. Every Sydney Morning Herald and Age newspaper had a post-it note attached to it, referring people to the fold-out. There's a couple of things happening via the internet, which I think are quite unique, and the way we're running some of the television ads is also quite unique. The way they've been spaced and so on.
Has that been born out of anything that's come out of the research in the lead up to the launch of this car?
I think that's just come out of our initiative. I think we researched the type of media, but we didn't research you're going to like a four-page fold-out. I mean, these are things that have come to us really from the media organisations themselves as trying to offer something unique to us to help us launch this car.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. So the last question. Tom, Kim Richardson. I know a lot of people have come here today to acknowledge you. I know I have. You single-handedly tried to save Tonsley. Lonsdale fell away, and I congratulate you for that. The sale of the Lonsdale site and the land, etc., could you share with us how that's all going?
We've got a contract now on the major part of the site, the South Australian company. We've actually sold, I think, about 5 hectares off to another company who's building a factory down there, a company called PBR, who build brakes for us and Toyota and Holden, I think. They're now occupying quite a large section of one of the buildings out there. But the other company that's bought the overall complex, that contract will be, I think, finalised early next year. And the hope is that they'll be able to attract smaller businesses into the area, into the complex, and so far I think there's been a lot of interest. So I think it's gone quite smoothly so far.
Thanks, Tom.
And I'm going to just correct one thing, Kim, once and for all, that I haven't single-handedly done anything. Right? It's just that I've had to front the media from time to time about issues. There's some people there the people who put this car together, you know, we have a guy down at Tonsley Park named Grant Hannon. And I've told this story many times. Back in 2001, because of the way we were doing things here on a shoestring, still struggling, but he so impressed the German shareholders, because DC were involved at that stage, they asked Grant to go over and head up a turnaround team in a company called Nedcar in Holland. And this was a $300,000-a-year plant, which is a joint venture with Mitsubishi and Volvo, and it was losing money like you would never believe. And they asked Grant to set up a team and go over and work on it, and they gave him access to anybody he wanted out of Daimler Chrysler and Mitsubishi anywhere in the world. He put a team together, and in 6 months he turned around. What that did is demonstrate very clearly, because these people didn't know us, and you have to, you know, as I said, relationships are important. We had no relationship, so we had no, in the Germans' eyes, you know, we were a country down there. They didn't know who we were or what we did. They could see we were losing money and we were struggling and so on. But this clearly demonstrated that we had the capacity, the management capacity and the skill for a $1 billion investment. That's what happened, right? So, and I've just hung on the shirt tails of that all the way through. That's I think, has still been the key reason why we were given the go-ahead in the first place.
And I think, Tom, that you're a leader of people and you're a very humble man.
Yeah, thank you. Get it?
There wouldn't be a person here who knows that Tom hasn't worked enormously hard over the last how many months to put this car through its production process and now get it literally onto the road. His tank must be empty, his battery must be flat, and all those other cliches. But Tom, thank you for giving us of your time today. I noticed that in everything you said, you didn't deny that you had a 3 handicap down at Goolwa.
Oh, I forgot about that.
No, don't deny it.
Since I've been at Mitsubishi, my market share has gone like that and my golf handicap's gone like that. So it's well and truly into very high double figures.
It was interesting that you, instead of selling your car, you gave us some fairly sobering messages about the future of the work market or the workforce market, the workforce trends in South Australia. It's typical of you that you're looking onto the next thing rather than back to what you've already achieved. But I think every person in this room and probably every person in South Australia owes you a great deal of debt for pulling Mitsubishi along and for finally getting this car on the road. From us all at the Press Club and from everyone here, thank you very much for giving of your time today. Thank you.
This is a magnum of St Hugo from Orlando, but someone suggested, I think it was Bob Main, suggested it might be a Mitsubishi Magnum.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's all I know about cars. We're starting to press for time, but I'd like to thank you all for coming. Thank our sponsors once again, particularly Telstra. Could I ask Felicity Ann Lewis, the Mayor of Marion, to come up and join me? Hope your eyes are good, because you're going to read out the...
Mayors are pretty good at this
sort of
thing. We do it fairly often.
I know. We've got the first one we're going to pull for is the Forex Gold, the Australian.
Oh, no, I'm going to put that one back.
Well, you want it?
The CEO.
Put that
you back. Can't put it. Yes, I can. I'm the mayor. He's my only employee, and I put it back. The black E79, and it's got no name on it. There you are, this young lady down here.
Oh, really?
I hope you didn't want that, Mark. We actually don't have a contract with Telstra. Actually have a contract with somebody else. I'm sorry, Michael. Couldn't have a Telstra pie.
I don't know whether we're taking these in order of value or anything else, but...
Telstra phone's very good.
Telstra, a mobile phone. Mobile phone. Thank you, Telstra.
Oh, now I've pulled yours out, Rex. Do you reckon? I'm going well so far, everybody, aren't I? I'm good at this, as I said. Lots of practice.
That's not bad.
Green one this time. E6, Jim Matten. Matten, something like that.
Take it, Jim. You've never won anything.
Oh, he took something small. Isn't that humble? Another orange this time. Orange, E50. Nobody, no name on there. E50. Somebody? Well done. How are we going?
Well.
Take the big one?
That's it.
Why not?
That's it.
Okay. Well done.
Thank you very much. And it should have passed no one that the winner of the main prize was the man who first put his hand up and said, I bought one of these Mitsubishi 380s. Well done, Eric. A very appropriate winner of the main prize. I've lost control of my running sheet, so I'm not sure what I'm going to say. I know that I'll be belted by Susan Karakousis for not following the running sheet, but there you go. I'd simply like to say once again to Tom, thank you very much. We appreciate all you've given us today, because we all know that your time frame is enormously busy. To all of you for coming today. Now here we are. I'm getting nagged now. She's given me 500 words unannounced. The next luncheon, is that what it is? The next luncheon, Monday, 31st of October. Rashida Ali, daughter of Muhammad Ali, daughter and carer of Muhammad Ali. I'm not going to go into the details, because there's someone that really needs no introduction. I don't know whether she plays off 3 handicap at golf. But that's on October 31, same venue. That promises to be an amazing lunch. I once met Muhammad Ali in Piccadilly in London. I called him Cassius Clay, and he was going to pick a fight with me because he just changed his name. So I'll certainly be at that lunch. But to you all, those that haven't been to these lunches before, welcome and thank you. To everyone, thank you very much, and a very warm thanks to Tom Phillips for all he's done for us today. Thank you very much indeed.